ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Today, you're going to meet someone who is more than just the president of his country. He's someone who pushes his weight around on the international stage.
To seduce, to persuade, to charm, to nudge world leaders.
But as you're also going to hear, it doesn't always work out the way he wants. He leads a major country, it's on the UN Security Council, and it's a close ally of Australia. The leader we're meeting today is Emmanuel Macron.
I can hear you. Who is that?
This is Hamish. I'm the host of the show.
Hello, Hamish, host of the show.
Sophie Petter is the Paris Bureau Chief for The Economist, based in Paris. She's also covered a number of French presidents,
including the election of Emmanuel Macron, both the first time and the second time.
And she's written a book, Revolution Française, which chronicles Macron's remarkable rise from independent outsider all the way to the Élysée Palace. She's met him a whole bunch of times, as has Stephen Brady, who was Australia's ambassador to France between 2014 and 2017.
And that covered, of course, the ascendancy of Macron to the presidency.
Stephen is also actually only the second Australian civilian ever to receive France's Commander of the Legion of Honour. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And also with me is William Drozdiak, foreign editor and chief European correspondent for The Washington Post.
And wrote a book of my own about Emmanuel Macron a couple of years ago.
It was called The Last President of Europe.
Yes, very nice to meet you over the radio.
The same to you, William. Sophie knows me, yes.
I most certainly do.
Yes.
And it's a great pleasure to talk to you again.
There aren't too many French presidents who've had much of an impact on Australian politics, but Emmanuel Macron is the exception. Not long after being elected as France's youngest ever leader back in 2017, Macron made world headlines with this somewhat surprising compliment in a press conference with then Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull about his wife, Lucy.
I wanted to thank you for your welcome. Thank you and your delicious wife for your warm welcome. Thanks to you and Lucy. Thank you very much, Mr. Prime Minister.
Delicious partners aside, it was only a few years later that Macron had a far more profound impact on Australia's politics, directly accusing the Prime Minister of the day, Scott Morrison, of being a liar.
He lied to you?
I don't think. I know.
He's a straight-talking, ambitious global figure who wants France to help solve the challenges of our time. But at home, he can be a divisive figure, and he's facing a wave of discontent. So how did Emmanuel Macron start his own party and effectively come from nowhere to win two presidential elections? A charismatic centrist storming the Élysée, just as far-right populism sweeps Europe. I'm Hamish McDonald, and this is Take Me to Your Leader. Stephen, I want to start with you. You've met Macron a bunch of times as a diplomat when he's on show doing business. What's he like?
I think to meet him is to be immediately impressed by his presence. He actually has a presence that is palpable. He loves good quality discussion, debate. He has a intellectual rigour to him that he demands of himself and he demands of others. He does tend to lecture a bit.
Is that where the arrogant tag comes from?
Well, look, the arrogance tag is very hard when you've worked for Rothschild's bank. As an investment banker, it probably comes with the territory. But he is somebody who came to office aged very young, he was 39, when you ask yourself what are the qualities of a 38-year-old which make a person think that they could be president of the French Republic. And I think that he would have looked around the cabinet table when he was Minister for the Economy and he would have had that moment where he realised he was as good, if not better, than some of the others. His achievement was extraordinary. To come from nowhere and with no political party structure, effectively elected by social media, and to construct a grassroots campaign that got him to the Élysée was something that owed itself to his supreme self-confidence and, critically, to his self-discipline.
France's political landscape has been dramatically reshaped with the centrist independent Emmanuel Macron elected the next French president.
In front of what once was a home for French kings, Emmanuel Macron is writing another chapter in this country's history.
Je veux enfin avoir un mot.
It's been an extraordinary rise. He's never held elected office, and a year ago his party didn't even exist.
Vive la France!
Sophie, I think you've got boxes and boxes of notebooks from your meetings and interviews and encounters with Emmanuel Macron. Can you distill all of that down into something that gives us a sense of the person?
difficult, but I'll have a go. I mean, I first met him in 2012, so he was at the time a completely unknown figure. He had no public image at all. He was working for François Hollande, who was a socialist president at the time, and he was the his economic advisor at the Élysée. So obviously I'm a journalist from The Economist. I spent a lot of time going to talk to him. And that was when I started filling up these notebooks. But my notebooks are sometimes incredibly sort of anodyne. It's things like, you know, GDP growth and inflation rates. And
inspiring stuff.
Exactly, really inspiring stuff. But over the years, what I thought was very interesting in talking to him was that he did have this capacity to sort of think very laterally and creatively about the way in which politics was changing. And one of the things that he talked about to me at the time, so we're talking, you know, 2 years before he became an economy minister, he was talking about how politics was changing, that the big subjects of the day, that's to say the environment or technology, were no longer dividing the left from the right, were dividing the sort of center ground from the extremes. And this was a quite radical, different way of looking at politics. With sort of retrospect, going back and looking at those notes, which I did when I started to write my biography of Macron, I realized that this was all cleverly sort of forward thinking that was founding the basis for the party that he then went on to create, En Marche, and that took him to the presidency.
Macron established a political party in 2016. It was called En Marche, a year before he was elected president. And it was actually the first real indication that he intended to run for the top job. Many people point out, coincident or not, that En Marche has the same initials as he does, Emmanuel Macron. Last year, he changed the party's name to Renaissance.
Well, don't forget, when you found a party, it's not just about having the ideas. You've got to take people with you. You've got to persuade every single one of the people that he involved in that party. You are the only one who can, and then he would give them their job.
William, you, like Sophie, have written a book about him, and I suppose to dedicate that much of your time and life to doing so, you must have to admire something about them. What is there to like about Emmanuel Macron?
Well, when I embarked on the book project and spent about 6 or 7 hours with him, I was struck by his enormous self-confidence, his belief that he could charm or seduce just about anyone.
He sounds like unbearable traits, to be honest, the way you describe him.
Well, this is right. I mean, this is what I started out on the book. I said, how could a 38-year-old who'd never been elected to office aspire to become president of the republic and have the confidence and belief in himself to do this? But it's led to this stubbornness, this ambition, this arrogance, as some would say, has led to some of the setbacks in his presidency, such as the belief that he could charm characters as disparate as Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin into becoming his partners in foreign policy. And of course, in both cases, he failed miserably.
I think it's always worth going back somewhere close to the beginning. William, Macron didn't grow up in sort of luxurious surroundings. He was born in the northern city of Amiens in 1977. Both his parents were doctors, but they were a long way from the centre of power in Paris. Is it easy to pigeonhole or describe his upbringing?
Well, when you look at the history of his youth, just the fact that he fell in love with his teacher and persisted in wooing her to become his wife many years later in a small town in northern France suggests that willingness to take on the mores and values and establishment in such a way, it became a huge scandal in his town. But he's carried that belief with him that what he does is the right path, and if others challenge him, he will take them on.
He also thanked his wife Brigitte, who appeared on stage with him. But the move attracted an enormous amount of media interest abroad, for Brigitte is a grandmother and 24 years older than Mr. Macron. He was her pupil in the northeastern French city of Amiens. She was married at the time with a daughter the same age in the same class, but gradually became drawn in by his intelligence.
What was it in those early days, and how big a deal was it at the time, and how's it shaped him?
Well, the bourgeoisie of Amiens were scandalised by this. You know, he was a married woman who was considerably older. She was never actually his teacher. She was his drama teacher. That was a kind of after-school club that he took part in, and that's when he fell under her charm. His parents were scandalised. They sent him packing off to Paris to finish his schooling, and in the hope that this would all pass by, that this would be a sort of a passing phase in a teenager's life, and told her, Brigitte, to stay away from him until Macron was 18. But of course, it didn't happen, and he was up and down on that train from the Gare du Nord to Amiens to see her, even while he studied in Paris. So I think their relationship is really interesting to watch. You know, they're very, very close. I think that he relies on her judgment a lot, especially sometimes in a way in the early days. I felt that it was the sort of dramatic element of politics, the theatre of politics, when he was on stage, when he was speaking, that she, her advice on her criticisms, you know, she would tick him off if she thought he'd done a good job, and not a lot of people around him. That you've heard how, you know, he does intimidate people. Not a lot of people sometimes feel they can do that. She would absolutely go in there with a finger wagging, no, do that again. So I think it's an interesting relationship. It's very natural. It's, you know, lasted all the way through the presidency in a time which has been obviously very difficult for her.
I agree with you, Sophie. I'd add just one thing, that in his first presidential campaign, he was subject to a disinformation and vilification campaign, mainly questioning the authenticity of that marriage. And the source of this was Russia. And it was something that Macron very bravely tackled with Putin directly at their first meeting in Versailles.
What was being pushed by the Russians?
Well, I think the Russians were just stirring the pot there. Their favourite candidate was clearly Le Pen.
So just here, Stephen is referring to Marine Le Pen, the leader of the far-right National Rally political party. Le Pen has run three times for the presidency, the last two times against Macron.
Macron's relationship with his wife is at all times affectionate, genuine, and very important to his being.
Macron's actually made his frustrations with people talking about his wife and her age really clear. He once told a French newspaper, if I'd been 20 years older than my wife, nobody would have thought for a single second that I couldn't be. Sophie, you interviewed some of his teachers. What did they tell you about him as a young person?
Well, I think the thing that's always struck me about his childhood, and that all the people I spoke to, whether they were teachers or schoolmates of his, one of his best friends at the time, the thing that came back time and time again, and I found absolutely fascinating, was this sense of him being very different. You know, when I can remember one of the interviews I did with him for my book, he said, you know, I'm a half-breed. I've always felt like I'm different to everybody else.
I'd also add that as someone from Amiens, it's an area that we have to remember really suffers from deindustrialization. It's a kind of French rust belt. When I'd go there, you would easily encounter three generation unemployed. Whilst that wasn't his immediate reality, I think the fact that he came from Amiens did influence his political thinking.
This was a kid who was, you know, clearly gifted, did well at school, good grades, you know, good at sport, and was pretty sociable too, but he was always sort of in his books or going home at the end of the day, spent a lot of time with his grandmother, this figure Manette, who lived in an apartment very close to the family home. And after school, you know, instead of hanging out at the school gates like some kids might do, he would go and sit in her apartment and listen to her from a young age, reading out, you know, chapters from Molière and Racine. And she would sort of engage his mind in this almost kind of intellectual mentoring exercise. It was both the, you know, the real sort of founding of him, because that relationship with Manette, his grandmother, was incredibly strong, and he was really shaken when she died.
What did he learn from Manette?
I think a love of literature, a love of the French language, a love of French culture, an intellectual independence and a foundation which has carried him through. Don't forget, you know, he went to the top French postgraduate civil service college, but at the same time, he just happened to do a master's degree in philosophy. It makes some people quite intimidated when they talk to him because they think he's going to kind of come back and use vocabulary they don't know and use words that they don't know and references they don't know. And that can intimidate a lot of people, even in France.
Well, I remember listening to a couple of his speeches, and he would sprinkle these speeches with references to Pericles, to Malraux. You know, this is very alien to the Australian experience.
It sounds a little ostentatious.
Well, it borders on the pretentious, but that's seen from our Australian perspective. The French public expect that degree of erudition and articulateness.
He learnt to play the piano. He particularly loves Schumann and Liszt. And he was nicknamed the Mozart of the Elysee. William, have you heard him? Is he any good?
Well, I think he would be the first to admit that he is no Arthur Rubinstein, but sometimes in moments of frustration retreats to the piano to pound away and find solace in music when he's facing difficult times.
Sophie, I think when you look at the journey that he made to the presidency on paper, it's almost unbelievable because it's only a short time after he takes on this role in François Hollande's staff that he then becomes the finance minister and then not long after forms his own party. What on earth happened?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think it's a combination of a constitution where the president is directly elected. And when Charles de Gaulle founded the Constitution for the Fifth Republic in 1958, the idea was to make that link between an individual and the electorate absolutely direct. In other words, not to pass through parties. But I think what Macron saw was that this constitution made it possible, if you could get the circumstances right, for any individual to come from, in effect, nowhere, to go all the way to the presidency without ever having been elected to anything else. In other words, going through a party was not crucial, and that is what he saw.
Can I just inquire about that a little more, though, Sophie?
Yeah.
Because isn't what you're describing exactly what Le Pen Senior and then Marine Le Pen, the daughter, have tried to do? You know, smash through the barricades of these establishment parties and take the presidency, but they've tried so many times and failed. He did it in the first go.
Well, a couple of points. One is that she has done it through the party. Don't forget that the National Front, the party her father founded, has been around for decades. And where Macron saw the opportunity was the sort of, you know, the rise of the extreme and the collapse of the centre-right and the centre-left enabled him to sort of colonise that centre and use the constitution to create En Marche, get a sort of momentum behind him, take advantage and seize opportunities when he saw them. He also was the one who announced that he would run for the president, making it almost impossible and in effect impossible for Hollande to run. So, you know, Hollande called him a traitor and it's hard to see it any other way. It worked, but, you know, he was ruthless. Let's not forget he was also ruthless.
He came into office with a charismatic legitimacy. And I think when he got to the presidency, he assumed that he had more political capital than, in fact, he really did.
And did that mean, Sophie, that when protests took place in France, some of them directed towards him, that it shocked him more than it might otherwise have?
Quite possibly. I mean, I think two things happen. One of them is he can be extremely charming, he's engaging, he's very empathetic. One of the things that's always struck me, and it's a real puzzle, is how he's utterly failed to project that in public in France. The connection he makes with individuals when he's with them in a room, and he can do this, they don't have to be members of his policy circle or the French elite. They can be people he's met on a housing project or, you know, people on the ground. But nonetheless, in a small group, he has this empathy. In public, he really struggles. And therefore, I think, you know, that the disconnection has always come as a surprise to him. When he sees these uprisings, and my goodness, we've seen them, it always comes as a shock, I think, that he doesn't see himself as that person that the French see.
And he perhaps hasn't fully grasped how deep the mistrust is of politics by the French.
Emmanuel Macron is set to be re-elected as the French president.
Suggests that Mr. Macron has triumphed with around 50.
He did win a second election in 2022, again against Marine Le Pen. And I think the broader context is worth going back to here. He won that first election with a 66% majority. He was the youngest French leader since Napoleon. At the same time, Donald Trump was arriving in the White House. The UK had just voted to leave the European Union. There's this tide of populism sweeping Europe. And so for everything you describe about him and his relationship with the French population, he succeeds electorally. How do you help us understand that, William?
Well, I think that part of his vision of the world, he saw breaking down in not right and left, but more populist nationalists such as Le Pen and also those who would promote the world order, the liberal world order. And this is what his vision was for the European Union. That's when he laid out his blueprint for the future of the European Union in that speech at the Sorbonne. And as he told me, he was extremely disappointed that it did not resonate with other leaders, notably Angela Merkel of Germany, in aligning with him and to push Europe forward. He said he pleaded with other leaders, look, if you disagree with my ideas, come forward with your own. And yet they never did.
William, do you think as a world leader, he still feels a bit like that schoolboy in the north of France that didn't feel quite like the other kids?
Well, I think there is that feeling of being an outsider, an outcast, if you will. One of my last conversations with him, we were talking about what the world will look like in 30 years. He said it'll be the spectacular transformation of Africa. He said one in three human beings by the end of the 21st century will be African, and this will be the shape of the world to come, which, you know, he was giving a lot of thought to this at a time when you would think he'd be more preoccupied with internal politics in France.
Sophie, how do you explain his continued electoral success in the context of everything we've been discussing here? You know, he sort of is almost the embodiment of all of the things that so many voters now dislike and despise and distrust. He is the almost polar opposite of the populist wave, and yet he won the two elections in the face of all of that.
Well, I mean, you say that he represents what people despise. It depends which sort of people you're talking about. And in a way, France has become a kind of test case for whether that centre ground can resist. You know, let's look at a little bit of what Macron's actually done in office. You know, France has actually grown faster its economy than all the big other European countries over the last 5 years. The unemployment has come down to a 15-year low. You know, France, it has been transformed in terms of its image as a sort of investment location. We've had incredible growth of the French luxury firms. And then I think you're looking at the hangover of what he did in 2017, you know, because he had upended the whole party system and in effect crushed the socialists on the left, crushed the centre-right Republicans. They were just not strong enough to come back and provide a credible alternative in the French system.
The French always talk amongst themselves of their pouvoir d'achat.
What's that?
That is their purchasing power, the pouvoir d'achat. And their purchasing power has actually increased the most for those on the lowest salaries.
But so why is he upset so many people? It must be more than just the pension reforms and sort of small policy pieces. A lot of people have taken to the streets. A lot of people don't like this guy and don't like his presidency.
It's interesting. It's something somewhat rather unique, I think, in France. So while they have scored some achievements in his policies and made life better for many French people, there's still this distrust of leadership. On the one hand, the French want strong leadership from their presidents, but then they seem to be prepared to chop off his head. And I remember lecturing to some students, you know, I said, look, if you really want to see dysfunctionality, come to Washington, D.C., but you have it pretty good in France with free education and universal health care. And I remember a French writer friend telling me, you don't understand, Bill, France is a paradise inhabited by people who think they're living in hell. And this is the attitude that's This seems to drive a lot of the protesters.
Now,
hey, Michelle, can I just tell you one quick story? I had a French friend who knew how Macron had created his official presidential photograph. Now, this official presidential photograph hangs in every town hall, it hangs in the schools, it hangs in public buildings. Macron took inordinate care with the symbolism of every item in that photograph. In the photo, you see an open leather-bound book of de Gaulle's war memoirs. He or she is meant to see Macron as the 21st century advocate of modern France, of his ability to embody the nation, a la de Gaulle. And in a way, that so-called Jupiterian theory of the presidency...
What do we mean by Jupiterian?
The Jupiterian was his own... am I right, Sophie? That was his own description?
Absolutely yeah. was, yes. Mm. Way back,
yeah,
before
way
he
back.
Was even a minister.
Yes. It's for Australians, this is anathema, this idea of describing a presidency in grandiose terms.
Now, Stephen... I imagine as Australia's ambassador to France, generally speaking, it's probably a nice gig, a good relationship, a healthy, robust relationship, but, you know, lots of things to celebrate and share, maybe some talks of trade relationship from time to time. You might visit some war graves or war ceremony moments throughout the calendar. But in many ways, the relationship between these two countries blew up spectacularly just a few years ago. Australia had signed a $90 billion submarine contract with France, and then suddenly the Australian Prime Minister of the day ended it, stopped it dead in the water, because Australia had signed up to a new security pact with the United States and Britain, and this was to become known as AUKUS. Australia would be procuring and helping build, in the longer term, nuclear-powered submarines instead of the diesel-powered subs that we would have purchased from France. And this infuriated Emmanuel Macron, and he is asked some questions about this and whether Scott Morrison, Australia's Prime Minister, had lied to him.
It's a very bad news for credibility of Australia, and a very bad news for the trust that great partners can have vis-a-vis Australia. So I had a very direct discussion with Prime Minister Morrison about this issue. I do respect sovereign choices, but you have to respect allies and partners, and it was not the case with this deal.
Do you think he lied to you?
I don't think. I know.
It's quite something to call the leader of another country a liar, isn't it, Stephen?
It is. And, you know, my term as ambassador coincided with the love affair, or to use William's words, the seduction, the marriage and the consummation of the relationship through the $90 billion submarine deal. I haven't had to deal with the acrimonious divorce or the alimony.
Macron and Malcolm Turnbull got along very well,
They got along so well.
Pretty similar guys, maybe, in some respects.
I think they looked at each other and saw themselves. And I was there at the dinner that Macron put on for Prime Minister Turnbull in the garden of the Elysee. And Macron began the evening quite extraordinarily by saying this was the first time in the history of the Fifth Republic that a conversation of such wide-ranging but also detailed discussions about the submarine deal would be conducted in English. Now, that hadn't occurred before. And Turnbull, I think, was seduced by the charm that Macron turned on that evening. They became friends. By the time the dinner finished, they had exchanged their personal mobile numbers. The issue of how Prime Minister Morrison terminated that huge contract will be studied, obviously, by scholars, by diplomats, by analysts. In my view, it was wrong to text a president of another country, let alone a president of France, a couple of minutes to midnight, and tell him that we were pulling out.
That's how we let them know.
And that's how we let them know.
Another dimension, I would say, is the feeling of betrayal by the Biden administration.
Mm-hmm.
Wounded Macron deeply because he thought he had a very sensible and sound relationship with Biden. And Biden himself admitted that it was very badly and clumsily handled by his administration, particularly at a time they were trying to build up European support for a new policy in the Indo-Pacific that would help contain China. And France, alone among European powers, has a presence there, 5 military bases, 2 million of its citizens spread across Polynesia, in which France could play a significant role in supporting a Western policy in the Indo-Pacific. And that was really threatened. The degree of outrage in France was reflected in the withdrawal of its ambassador here in Washington, something that had never been done in 200 years.
And the ambassador here in Canberra. But this was not just a $90 billion contract. This was with a country that we had a declared strategic partnership. And so the blow to Macron personally, you know, was profound.
Sophie, does Macron forgive and forget, or is this something that Australia will pay for some time?
So it's interesting. I mean, I think I was in Paris at the time and, you know, you could feel the anger, the bitterness, the resentment. It's right away was absolute fury. Now, I think what happened was interesting is that Biden very, very quickly and very smartly realized how he had not handled this well. And the relationship with Biden was patched up pretty quickly. It was never patched up with Boris Johnson, who was the British Prime Minister at the time. And in Australia's case as well, it was the change of Prime Minister that changed everything.
That's true. But I think that French foreign policy does have an institutional memory. And in Australia's case, we are seeing in the final stages of our negotiations of a free trade agreement with the European Union.
Sorry, you think it's a direct result of the submarine deal going sour?
I think so.
You think the free trade agreement with Europe has been jeopardised?
Yes.
It is clear that Macron sees himself not just as a French leader or a European leader, but as a global leader, and he's inserted himself into every international crisis really since the beginning of his presidency, and even more so, I think it's fair to say, since the German Chancellor Angela Merkel left the stage. He famously chastised Donald Trump for moving the US embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. He met with Vladimir Putin on Europe's behalf and tried to stop him from invading Ukraine. He's warned Europe against getting too involved in the Taiwan independence issue after meeting with Xi Jinping in China. Sophie, can you draw that all together for us and help us understand the way Macron sees himself in the world?
Well, I think there are two things. One of them is how France sees itself in the world. And don't forget that France doesn't think of itself as just a sort of middling power and doesn't like the idea that it would just ever count as one. It sees itself as punching above its weight. It's a member of the United Nations Security Council. It's a nuclear power. And France has this sort of geographical presence on five continents. You know, it's got territories in Africa and the Pacific Ocean, Indian Ocean, in Latin America. So there is this concept that the French have of counting in the world. So I think that's the sort of, that's the background for any leader. Onto that, you then have to bolt Macron as someone who thinks that he can persuade people to do things that others can't. And I think we saw that with Trump, which never worked, but he really thought he could establish this relationship, then he could persuade Trump to somehow, you know, move in directions that France or Macron wanted, and that wasn't possible.
He had a kind of curious relationship with Trump, didn't he? It was sort of weird.
Well, it was, and, you know, he invited him to the 14th of July, the Bastille Day, National Day parade, and invited him and his wife up the Eiffel Tower for a meal with Brigitte and Emmanuel Macron. It was, you know, our absolute seduction attempt, but and
did
quite strange. Well, you know, you just have to look at the results, don't you? You know, at one point, Trump said, you know, Emmanuel, he's my friend. But honestly, it produced nothing in terms of results.
Diplomatic efforts to defuse the conflict over Ukraine have ramped up. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, flew into Moscow for talks with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
In Russia, the French president was trying to close the growing divide between Moscow and the West over the build-up of Russian troops near Ukraine.
We had a conversation that saw a number of propositions emerge.
Some of his ideas and proposals could form a basis for our further joint steps.
Unfortunately, exactly the same thing would be said with Putin, the effort to try and talk him out of war. You know, it wasn't just that last-ditch effort to go to Moscow. I was on the plane with Macron for that trip. And, you know, it was a very, very tense and nervous moment. You know, Macron's not, he's not naive. He knew perfectly well that this was extremely high-risk mission, but he felt it was no alternative but to make that one last attempt. But it wasn't just about going to Moscow shortly before Putin invaded Ukraine. It was also about, over the years, ever since he was elected in 2017, trying to kind of charm Putin back into the democratic kind of European geography. This is what he thought he could do. He invited Putin to Versailles. He laid on a dinner for him in July, just a few couple of months after his election. So I think that the bigger picture is one of an attempt to seduce, to persuade, to charm, to nudge world leaders, which has had, you know, mixed results at best and not very, very many results in reality.
Sophie, were you on the plane with him on the way back?
Yeah.
What was his mood like then? What did you talk to him?
Well, yes, we did. And we went Paris, Moscow, then we went Moscow to Kyiv. So we went to go and see Zelensky then. And that was a kind of reporting back. Zelensky was stony faced and extremely skeptical about Macron's account of his discussion with Putin, which if you could, you remember the image, they were around this huge table, allegedly put in place for COVID reasons, but it looked very much like a message to Macron, sticking him at the end of this long table. Macron thought after that discussion, they talked until one in the morning for about 6 or 7 hours, and he thought that he had secured from Putin a guarantee not to be the cause of escalation at the border. Well, you know, that turned out to be a completely empty promise, even if Macron believed it, and Zelensky certainly didn't when he turned up in Kyiv. You know, I think Macron thought he could do something that others couldn't, and in the end, he thought he could use reason and rationality and lay out the consequences for Russia of an invasion and how dramatic those would be, and that would be enough to persuade Putin not to do what he did.
It's striking that he did this against the advice of many of his foreign policy advisors. And this, again, is a reflection of Macron willing to go his own way, his extreme self-confidence in believing he could somehow persuade and even seduce Putin. And of course, he did not.
That flirtation with Putin pre-invasion and then afterwards trying to present himself as, you know, the voice of Europe was dangerous. After the invasion, you'll recall that he said that Putin should be given some security guarantees. But let's add a couple of others. The fact was that he has not convinced Germany of any sense of urgency on either a Eurozone budget or an EU army, both of which he has proselytized ad nauseum. He in no way moderated Trump during his term. The backlash after his recent visit to China, that was very bizarre. The interview that he gave that suggested that Chinese aggression to Taiwan, let alone a Ukraine-like invasion, was not Europe's business. That raised huge alarm bells within the national security community in Canberra. And in many ways, it confirmed the rightness of AUKUS. So he did himself no favours there.
I want to bring William in on that. What do you think Macron is doing in taking the position that he did, for example, on Taiwan and China and the way the rest of the world should react? Is it just about saying, look, we're not in lockstep with the Anglosphere, or is there something more to it?
No, I think he genuinely believes that Europe's interests could be jeopardized if it is dragged into an unwanted military confrontation with China by the United States. But I think he realized that what will happen to Europe if, let's say, the United States re-elects Donald Trump for another term next year, and then Trump will proceed, as John Bolton recently predicted, to try to extricate the United States from NATO. Then where does that leave Europe? And he's trying to alert and stimulate other leaders in Europe to examine these prospects. And that's why if Europe does not move ahead in terms of improving its own defenses, it risks being stranded. And here we are in a global situation of resurgent big power rivalry, pitting the United States against Russia and China, and Europe is sort of stranded in between. I think this was what he was trying to get at on Taiwan, and now the Biden administration has backed off and adopted the European language. He was talking about decoupling. Now they're talking about de-risking, and I think that's a reflection of the fact that Macron and other Europeans have pulled the United States back from the brink.
Macron has really shifted on two things. One of them is, and both have to do with Russia, and both are to do with the invasion of Ukraine. One of them is Ukraine and NATO. You know, Macron, the guy who told me at the time NATO is brain dead, has turned out to be a champion for Ukraine joining NATO. And the other point is enlargement of the European Union, which would include Ukraine. Again, France traditionally, like with NATO, somewhat skeptical, semi-detached attitude to enlargement. They're not particularly keen on diluting French influence in an even bigger European Union, or at least not until now. And now Macron's also become a champion not only of enlargement to Ukraine, but to Moldova, to the Western Balkans, and to create a bigger European Union on the basis that you can no longer, with Russia being the sort of power it is, have any gray zone in between the European Union and Russia. And that, to me, is a geopolitical change that has been sort of under-noticed, I think.
Sophie, what does Macron do with the rest of his term in office? He is serving until 2027. There's no obvious successor. There's broad discontent in parts of France, and Marine Le Pen still there, lurking on the sidelines. Is it more likely that at the end of his presidency, there becomes a Le Pen presidency?
Well, of course, that idea haunts him and it haunts a lot of us in France. The parallel with sort of two Obama presidencies followed by a Trump presidency is in everybody's minds in France. And it's not possible for him to stand again. The question of the succession it hasn't really been raised yet. You know, we're still 4 years out.
William, final thought to you. Has he made France more powerful?
Well, I think France has emerged, at least recognized by many in Washington, as the strongest and most significant power in Europe, and thus as a leading ally of the United States.
William, Sophie, Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Take Me to Your Leader. My guests, foreign editor and chief European correspondent for The Wash Post, William Drozdiak. His book on Macron is called The Last President of Europe. The Paris bureau chief for The Economist and author of Revolution Française, Sophie Petter, and Australia's ambassador to France from 2014 to 17 is Stephen Brady. This episode was produced by Greg Muller and Linda Lopresti. The executive producer is Maria Tickle. We love getting your feedback, so please continue sending it to tmtyl@abc.net.au. And of course, if you're on the ABC Listen app, give us a follow. I'm Hamish McDonald. See you next time. From humble beginnings to mayor to jail, a now powerful figure some are calling the new Sultan. On the next episode of Take Me to Your Leader, we get to know Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Democratically elected, but is his rule now becoming authoritarian?